I ask the audience the question, what of the non-Jews, what of the millions of Palestinians living in occupied territory in the West Bank, what of the millions that are living in the Gaza Strip? Mm. So, yes, there are starking similarities between the two.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, obviously this programme exposes the role of the Israel lobby. I mean, so I wonder what you could say about the Israel lobby groups that are already at work inside Twitter today.
Well, prior to Musk taking over, there was a pattern of activity whereby there was a Twitter safety council, and there were a whole series of groups brought in to advise Twitter on hate speech, on which accounts should be suspended. Now, these were dominated in the case of conflict areas by Zionist groups. There was one Muslim group which was itself very close to Zionism, so there was no voice in there at all defending the idea of Palestinian rights. So it was a very strong influence of Zionism in terms of content moderation from outside groups, but also it seems from inside groups, because there were many people who had previously worked in the CIA and the Pentagon, including one guy who in the UK who remains part of the 77th Brigade, the British Army's propaganda operation. Yeah. He was involved in content moderation on the Middle East, and he was one of the ones who was sacked. So there was a very strong grip in there of pro-Zionist messages in relation to Twitter. But now most of those people have been sacked, and that's the new territory we're in, because it looks like the possibility of a new freedom in Twitter, but it's not working out quite that way, as we saw in the film with the example of the Jihad Collectives, whose account has been suspended for no good reason.
Mm. I mean, it seems that Twitter's continuing to censor Palestinian groups and indeed their supporters. I mean, do you think Elon Musk could still make the changes that many people hope for, or...?
Quite frankly, I don't believe this somewhat saviour is coming to amplify our voices on a somewhat crusader mission, amplifying our voices on Twitter because of our campaigning for the human rights of Palestinian people, as we clearly see accounts such as Noura Erekat being permanently suspended, if I'm not mistaken. But now, after successful pressure, her account has now been restored. As long as individuals and organisations continue to platform online to defend and call for the human rights and expose the Israeli war crimes being committed in Palestine, we are going to see the Israeli lobby use its utmost effort on such platforms to silence individuals, which we have seen with Noura Erekat being one, and as the film mentioned earlier, other organisations.
I mean, it's probably worth pressurising Musk, though, isn't it, given his alleged commitment to freedom of speech, and sort of hold him to account on that, do you think?
And I believe that will be a testament of time.
Yeah.
In the sense, when we're focusing on Palestine with this new Israeli government that have said individuals within the government calling to be the landlords of their very own country, it will only be a testament of time to find out whether individuals, as well as organisations that continue to campaign for the human rights belonging to an oppressed people, will have their voices silenced.
Well, look, David, I mean, just tell us what the story is with the middleman for this Twitter deal, Ari Emanuel.
So Emanuel is referred to as a Hollywood super agent. He represents a huge list of A-list celebrities in L.A. and Hollywood. But he was called in to broker the deal when it looked like the deal was going south. Musk put in the offer and then withdrew the offer, and Emanuel was brought in to broker the deal. Now, he's close to Musk. Musk was at his wedding earlier this year, and indeed went on holiday with him in a Greek island off Mykonos as well. So and he is a part of the Emanuel family. He has two brothers, Zeke and Ram, both of whom are quite prominent in US politics, both of them strong Zionists, all three of them in the Democratic Party. But Rahm Emanuel is so hardline on Israel that Donald Trump actually funded one of his political campaigns. Yeah. But Ari is the agent in this case. Their father was a guy called Benjamin, right, who was in the Irgun, who was involved in arms smuggling for the Irgun, and allegedly involved in various assassinations and terror attacks in the process of the creation of the State of Israel. And Ari Emanuel himself, of course, regularly is involved with the Friends of the IDF and raising huge sums of money that they raise at their gala dinners. They spend millions of dollars every year to the IDF to support Israeli war crimes. So there's a clear sense there that in the milieu in which he operates, there's a very strong Zionist influence.
What about this alliance with this character, Barry Weiss? I mean, what do you know about that?
Well,
that's
more complicated, I think, because she was brought in to do the Twitter files, and there's been some really interesting stuff in the Twitter files, and it's well worth having a look.
Which, obviously, a credit, I suppose, to Moscow in actually releasing those.
Indeed. It's worth having a look at in depth. But she quickly fell out with him, right, over his statements about journalists, and so they got into a big spat. So although she's kind of she sort of cancelled herself from the New York Times, claiming there was all this anti-Semitism, you know, usual fake allegations. But then she's now being appointed by Musk to this role, and very quickly fell out with him about his arguments over journalists. So it's an interesting thing to see how this develops.
It'll be interesting to see how it develops. But we're going to just pause there for a moment because we want to just have a look now at a report on how Elon Musk's been involved in launching satellites for the Zionist regime.
From his very inception, Elon Musk's project SpaceX was very close to the CIA, enjoying support and investment from Mike Griffin, president at venture capital firm InQtel. But InQtel is not any venture capital firm. It's a CIA operation that cultivates companies to work with a national security state. Mike Griffin later went on to NASA, where he further assisted Musk in his ascent. Over the years, Musk's company has made billions on contracts to transport spy satellites, which aid in drone warfare and the gathering of military intelligence. One such customer has been U.S. arms firm Lockheed Martin, which gave Musk $500 million in 2018 to launch their GPS system. SpaceX was contracted by the U.S. Air Force to launch the command satellite, through which it maps targets. Musk also launched the spy satellites for the National Reconnaissance Office, which are used by both the NSA and CIA. Elon Musk later assisted the NATO proxy war in Ukraine by providing his Starlink satellites for use by the Ukrainian military against the Russian army. It is believed the satellites allow the Ukrainian forces to target using thermal imaging, even in harsh conditions. We now also know that Musk and his Starlink satellites are active in the regime change operation against Iran. When U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken commented on the need for the U.S. government to aid the flow of information in Iran, Musk personally responded to the tweet with the words, "Activating Starlink." He later tweeted the words, "Approaching 100 Starlinks active in Iran." Musk's collaboration with Israel against the resistance axis has taken an ominous turn. Recently, Musk's company, SpaceX, quietly launched spy satellites for the gathering of military intelligence for an Israeli intelligence company called ImageSat International. The CEO of the company, Noam Sigal, is a current reserve in the Israeli Air Force. The chief of marketing at the company is Barak Salamin, an active duty officer in the Israeli Air Force. The company is full of former and current Israeli military figures, as well as former employees of Israeli arms company Elbit Systems. Musk's collaborator ImageSat International has been a key component of Israeli airstrikes on Syria, and it's likely this launch serves a similar purpose. Both the company and the Israeli embassy in the US publicly thanked Musk and SpaceX on Twitter for facilitating the launch, a fitting tribute.
David, Elon Musk's SpaceX company is portrayed as a benign project that's focused on enhancing our understanding of the solar system and the wider universe. But I wonder if you could say something about its role in developing a kind of global surveillance infrastructure.
Well, let's remember that Musk's fortune is based in part on huge sums of money from the military-industrial complex. Whatever your views on politics or free speech, and he appears to have some kind of vaguely libertarian ideas, that's an anchor for how you will conduct yourself. You can't leave that anchor behind, because that's where you get your wealth from. So this is the key thing here. We've got to look at where the money comes from and how he's anchored economically as opposed to ideologically to the military-industrial complex. Now, the military-industrial complex in this case is predominantly US imperialism and is involved in global surveillance of populations which might pose a threat to US interests. Now, of course, that's as we speak today in Iran, in Syria, in Somalia, and various other places, right? So that's what his interests are, even though he might have a set of ideas which cut against those interests in some respects. So that's where we should be directing attention. And you see that in the involvement with the Israelis, you know, putting up satellites which are allowing Israeli effectively war crimes in the thousands of bombing raids they've done. There's 1,000 now on Syria in the last few years. These are against international law. They shouldn't be occurring. And Musk is facilitating them.
Mm, interesting, yeah. I mean, of course, and I remember when the coup in Bolivia took place, he tweeted out, you know, we will coup whoever we want to, didn't he? Which sort of gives away some of his where his sympathies perhaps lie. But Abraham, I mean, I wonder whether you could tell us what you know about this organisation, ImageSat International, that Elon Musk has worked with recently.
So essentially, ImageSat International is an Israeli intelligence firm, surveillance firm, whereby it's made up of, as the film showed us, members that have illustrious history, illustrious backgrounds in the Israeli military and private arms Israeli companies, such as that of Elbit Systems. And essentially what ImageSat International is that it takes pictures in colour and has been found in the past of taking pictures within Syria and providing coordinates to the Israeli Air Force to then later carry out strikes. As David just mentioned, in the last 5 years, at least 1,000 airstrikes have been carried out by Israel into Syria, which only makes us question how many other countries in that region alone are they surveying, spying on, providing coordinates for, not only within the Middle East, but across the entire world.
Mm. I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that Musk's assisting the Israeli war on the axis of resistance by launching these satellites containing hardware made by the notorious Elbit Systems. I mean, and we've covered the campaigns against Elbit on this show on a number of occasions before. But I wonder whether you could sort of update us really on what the latest is on the struggle against Elbit in the UK.
Well, just in case for first-time viewers, Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest private arms companies. They produce the drones that survey and kill Palestinians. And Palestine Action, which is an organisation that carries out direct action against Elbit Systems, is carrying out the Shut Down Elbit campaign, whereby they have already shut down a factory as well as Elbit's HQ in the heart of central London, and have cost Israel's war machine millions by applying pressure upon the pressure points of this monolithic structure, as it somewhat appears to be. As it currently stands, there are many activists within Palestine Action that have caught this month and throughout the year of 2023, and we must ensure that we do our utmost effort to support these individuals that have cost Israel's, one of Israel's largest private arms companies, millions. Mm. It's held them accountable to the countless war crimes it has committed in the Gaza Strip, the countless children, women, men, elderly, as well as those retaining physical and mental disabilities. Yeah. So we must be there as an act of support.
Sure, sure. I mean, David, Musk's involved in the regime change operation in Iran, isn't he, as well?
Well, he has this Starlink thing, isn't it, which is a means of communications which bypasses the internet or mobile phone signals to enable those who are involved in the riots and the subversion in Iran to try and communicate with Western sources. So, yes, he's been involved in that, and that's been, probably quite important in the attempt to foment the riots in Iran. But of course, overall, those attempts have failed. I mean, there's an attempt to do this in the last few months, but these have now failed, and it's not looking like it was a success. But certainly he was involved in that, and that's an indication, again, of his orientation towards the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about the Starlinks that you mentioned there. I mean, he's also had some input into the war in Ukraine as well, hasn't he? I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, and the same thing there, Starlink's there. But the interesting thing in Ukraine was his kind of ambiguous position on this. He's much more sympathetic to Russia, it seems, than you would expect from someone from that kind of background. And he threatened the Ukrainians that he was going to withdraw the Starlinks unless they paid for them. And they were outraged at this, the idea that they'd have to pay. And they were also complaining they weren't working properly. And said, well, you want them to work properly? Pay me the money. Yeah. And that's an interesting little kind of detail. But yes, he has been involved in that. And that appears to be continuing. But nevertheless, there's an ambiguity there about his relationship with Russia.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I mean, Ibrahim, I mean, looking forward as a young Palestinian journalist, I mean, I wonder whether you could tell us what your hopes are for Twitter as a means of expression.
I think first thing we have to do, Chris, is understand the reality that we live in today and how likely could there be a Palestinian journalist from a working class background or anybody that isn't white, upper class, a male within that demographic, using such platforms, whether it be that to even go to university, to particular occupations and particular jobs. I think what we really need to do is understand that we're in a particular position of power, and it could go even more some. I'm not trying to say that the position we're in now is I'm happy with it, but what we have to do is use Twitter and the tools that we have, capitalize on them, amplify our voices, ensure that this reality in our parents' generation alone was not a likelihood that could have happened, and how globalized we are and how connected we are in today's day and age. What is our excuse? When we are seeing people gather en masse in millions of numbers before an age of WhatsApp, before an age of Instagram, before an age where I can find out the war crimes that are happening in the Gaza Strip just before I lay my head to rest. What is our excuse in towards mobilizing? What is our excuse into using it as a means of expression?
Yeah, I mean, David, just finally and briefly, I wonder whether you could, just following up on, on what Ibrahim was saying there and just Twitter in general and being used as a tool, but it's also been used in a kind of negative way to kind of close down, pro-Palestinian voices. And I wonder whether you could maybe just list some of the organisations. We've touched on it a little bit in the past, but organisations like CST and so on and the actions that, that they've taken, lobbying Twitter to try and close down, limit people like ourselves, you and I.
Well, I think Twitter and social media in general is an ambiguous thing. These are dominated by Western corporations who have over-close relationships with both the military-industrial complex and with intelligence agencies, and thus, also with Zionist lobby groups. But there are alternatives emerging. In Russia and China and various places, and that's also critically important for the future. But lastly, the thing I would say is remember that mobile phones are also used for surveillance, and they're also used for targeting people in situations of conflict. So we can't be too optimistic about the possibilities of technology because they have negative.
Definitely pros and cons. Unfortunately, as ever, we've run out of time, but I'm afraid so we're going to have to leave it there. I hope you found this program informative again, and I want to thank our guests, Ibrahim Abul Esed, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. It takes courage to grow up and become who you really are. However, this growth and upbringing has a major play by parents. And in this program, we try to guide the parents how to take the proper steps to upbring their children in, under the umbrella of Islam. And the answers to your questions, issues are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The listeners, Professor Nakavi is a researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom and also a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. All right, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episode, you taught us beautifully that how through a virtual world one can connect his teens to the natural world. And we got to the point that seeing things, internet is necessary, technology is necessary, seeing things on internet is not enough, but it is important though that you get the information about, you get a knowledge about a particular thing or a particular place, and then you take in person your child or a teenager to the environment itself and make him ponder and think about the existence, his own and the existence of all environment, so that he can reach back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We also have been talking about the virtual world and how it's important just not to have virtual mentors, but also to have physical guide.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I begin this discussion of mine in the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being. It's quite difficult to carry out mentoring through the virtual world. You can teach people, you can teach them, but you cannot imbibe values. You cannot imbibe skills. It needs a physical presence, a face-to-face connection. Yes, again, you would say tomorrow the virtual world is going to progress so fast that it would become quite natural.
Yeah.
The interaction between two people in the virtual world will become very real. Sitting thousands of miles away with each other, they will be looking at each other as if they are looking at them physically.
Yeah.
Maybe that day comes.
Yes, there's a
metaverse coming. But even then, I would say that the human touch would be not there. So when I talk
nothing
about...
Nothing can replace actually the physical essence that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to humankind, even if it's metaverse.
Quite difficult. I mean, the human touch is something which is exclusive for the human, so the body and the soul, which are there together. I don't think the metaverse would be able to replace that. And therefore, physical contact, even if we teach our children about Islam through the internet, but we need a guide, we need a mentor, we need a coach, we need a person who is leading them, taking them, playing with them. Teaching is, the problem is today we think the teacher, the guide is a person who teaches us. No, that is not what Islam, yes, teaching is important. That is the first step, but that is not enough.
That's not the end of it.
So we need mentors and guides who take us along the path. I remember as children, we were members of the scouting, the Cub Scouts. We could go out in groups, make small groups and go out. So that was a movement at that time.
An activity, yeah.
An activity, a collective activity. Teamwork was developed. Today, our societies, unfortunately, there's no teamworking. There's no collective. Everyone is for himself. Those communities, those nations who have developed that community, such communities, and developed such movements within themselves, like for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran has the Basiji voluntary movement. That's a very important thing that has been established by the Islamic Republic in Iran by Imam Khomeini. That gives us this is one way of
a sense of voluntary, yeah, to act collectively.
But it should go beyond that. It should not just be limited to one
aspect. On a very local level.
So we need to, start from the grassroots, mm-hmm, and build up towards a society which is based on the imamat concept of imamat.
Yes. Inshallah, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Thank you.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi, and we are talking about the concepts of a virtual world and the relationship of a teen with this virtual world. You said that something has to be developed in child that takes him back to imamat, and how?
Basically, what is imamat? As I mentioned before, also, the imamat is the acceptance of not only the command of Allah Almighty. Imamat is obeying a human being based on the merit that that human being has. Basically, the concept and the institution of imamat is based on
obedience.
Obedience based on merit.
Okay.
A person who has the merit, has the competency to be the leader, to be the lord, to be the master, has to be followed.
So when you are teaching your teenager to be obedient, one thing that has to be kept into the minds is that he has not got to be obedient to each and every person who does not even deserve. He has to see the merits in terms of obedience.
Islam talks about meritocracy. It is based on merit. People who have the knowledge and the attributes, the morals to deal with other people, to show them how the path, they should be followed. They should be our guides. They should be our mentors. Imam is the person who takes us towards Allah Almighty. So he should have reached the Imam himself, Allah Almighty himself, to come back. So this concept of imamat should start from the top, from the pinnacle, and come down to into the society. And every one of us should be collectively working together towards that goal. And so if we develop such a society, yes, it can start from the virtual world. We can develop communities in the virtual world. But till that physical contact is not developed, at the grassroots levels, where we do not come together, eat together, drink together, play together, discuss together, learn together. This togetherness
is very important.
Very important. Inna al-mu'minuna ikhwa. Yadullahi ma'al jama'ah. The hand of God
is in the congregation.
Is in the congregation. Islam teaches us to pray even in congregation. The real namah, the essence of salah, is manifested in the congregation prayer.
And sometimes it says it's better than 44 other prayers that you offer.
We follow one imam. He leads us and we follow him. This
connectivity
is being taught to us even in prayers. So this is where we are lacking. Unfortunately, in our societies, the imam may be the person who just can recite properly. No, the imam should be there, even in prayers. Should be not just a good reciter of the Quran. He should be more than that. He should be beyond that. Unfortunately, today, imams, masjid imams are being employed just based on the fact that they know how to recite properly, or they know a few ahkam of Islam. That's not enough. They should be leaders of the society.
There should be something reflecting in their practical lives as
exactly.
well.
They should be true leaders. Not just prayer leaders, they should be leaders in all facets.
Yeah.
So that is the problem what we are facing. That concept of imamat says the person who leads us towards
Allah
Almighty, whether in the form of prayers or in other collective activities.
Activities are very important.
Whether they are social, economic, whatever.
Cultural.
Yeah.
We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for this.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Nakavi. Professor Nakavi, we said that obedience is a very important part of the connection that a teenager has to develop in the environment and relationship. And one of the best ways to develop this is the congregation prayers, where a teen attends the congregation prayers and he sees that all this jama'at, all this congregation is just following one single imam. And even that imam should have merits. He should be active not only in the, he should not just be a good reciter, but also having some collective social, cultural, political, and religious activities. Well, obedience, when it comes to teenagers' obedience, either they become completely disobedient or they become obedient without looking at the merits. When you talked about merits, I remind of a girl who was a teen, and then she had been doing hijab since her eight, since she was eight or seven, like from a very early age, even before the age of bulugh. And then once she is without hijab in her teens, and then when she's asked why you are without hijab, and she says, like, since I was out with my aunt who does not prefer to be in hijab, and I kind of felt disrespect. And my aunt was actually, if you want to come with me, so try not to come like an aunt, try to just dress up well. So do you think here a teen has obedience, but not for a meritful person?
Yes, of course. That, the problem with this is that we are not providing the proper definition of merit. What do we mean by merit? That is important. How do we define competency? That is important. What is the role model we are providing? The problem is that when we talk about the Imams and the Holy Prophet as our role models, then on the other hand we say, oh, we cannot become them like them. Of course we can't become like them. That's not possible. But that does not mean that we should not strive to become like them.
Yeah.
So we either go for the for that excellence, or we just drop down to the ground for, with zero merit. That is the problem with society. Our development of the human society and the human collective effort is not based on merit. Whether we go into politics, whether we go into social issues, whether we go into economic issues, merit is not the basis. When I talk about the prayer leader as the person being a meritorious person, when he comes into the society and leads the prayers, he also becomes a leader in all aspects. He takes the children and the flock who are being led by him and leads them and guides them in various aspects of their lives, in their family life, in their economic life, in their social life, in their. If we set up our communities based on the masjid, and our youth flock to the masjid, today the problem is our youth are not going to the masjid.
Yeah.
The elderly people are going to the mosque. Our youth are not there because that central pivot is not there. So we need mentors, guides who can be not only leaders in prayers; they have to be leaders in every aspect of society, of life, and the youth can look up to them. So if we are faced with a problem in society, as parents we are faced with teenagers who have these problems, we are not striving, as in the collective sense, to develop the society in such a way that we make such systems in our society. Of course, in the West, because we are in minorities, there are certain places, centers, but again, we do not have the people to lead those societies.
So whatever is being done is not enough. Have I got to know a point, very important one, that obedience is very important part that is to be taught to teenagers, but most important then is that who to obey. Maybe inshallah we'll discuss more on this topic in the upcoming sessions, because obedience is very, very important. Our children, our teenagers are not supposed to be disrespectful and disobedient. But as this question was put forward, does it mean to obey each and every one? Definitely no. Why and how, we'll discuss in upcoming sessions. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. Thank you so much to your listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know? Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
Democracy of Religion from Imam Khomeini's point of view. This is the words of Imam Khomeini. The rule of Islam is the rule of law. In this form of government, sovereignty is solely of Allah and Allah's law, commandment and decree. The law of Islam, or the commandment of Allah, has full authority over all individuals and over the Islamic government. All individuals, from the Honorable Prophet of Islam, over all individuals and over the Islamic government, all individuals from the Honorable Prophet of Islam, Muhammad al-Mustafa, peace be upon him and his family, to successors of His Holiness, and the rest of the individuals, are subservient to the law until eternity, the same law that has descended on behalf of the Almighty and exalted Allah, and has been expressed in the language of the Quran and the Prophet of Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Spring of Truth. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi. One of the point of views of Imam al-Khomeini radhiyallahu alayhi is that he said, "We have reached the station at which our nation exploded all at once and set off a revolution. Such an explosion has been matchless. A nation that had lost everything in the former regime, including his human dignity, and had to depend on others for everything. Then, suddenly, that violent outburst and the revolution was on, and it was by the blessings of this morning sessions that brought together all the people and focusing on one issue." Now, Imam al-Khomeini radhiyallahu alayhi, obviously, first he's trying to say that the revolution that happened in Iran, it's matchless. We have not seen any revolution through the course of history that could match the revolution of Iran. It was an outburst. It was the entire nation in uproar trying to change. Even though under the previous regime, they have lost everything, even their own dignity, but that all had to change. And the Imam says, this all was possible. It all happened because of the blessings of the mourning and processions and the majalis of Imam al-Hussein. People who were attending these majalis, the people who were attending these processions, they had one aim in mind, and that is to revolt against oppression, to revolt against oppressors, to make a change, to seek justice, to seek equality, and to seek everything that you have been denied. In the same way Imam al-Hussein did, we will do the exact same thing. And that made people explode, not just revolt. They exploded. And such explosion never seen in history. Why? Because it is an outcry from the depth of the heart of people that enough is enough. We should not succumb to humility. We should not be taken for a drive. We should not see our resources go to our enemy while we suffer. Poverty and lack of education, it was ravaging throughout the country. And people were poor, and they sit under the richest country on the planet. But the resources were going somewhere else. So people revolted, and the ignition to all this revolution, to this outburst, and to this explosion was, in fact, the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam that taught them to stand up for the right.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing domestic politics in Saudi Arabia with author and journalist Ali Al-Ahmad. But first, this brief analysis.
The fact that the country is named after the ruling family gives us insight into the basic reality of the so-called nation-state. Indeed, it highlights that Saudi Arabia is actually not a nation-state in the traditional sense, even though it is treated as such in international relations, but rather a family business established by Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman Al Saud with the help of the British in the early 20th century in order to destabilize, divide, and conquer the Ottoman Empire, culminating in the establishment of what is today called Saudi Arabia in 1932, when Abdulaziz conquered and annexed the Kingdom of Hejaz, which includes Islam's holiest cities of Mecca and Medina, contrary to the wishes of Abdulaziz's British benefactors. This action by Abdulaziz might have something to do with the fact that American oil companies discovered oil just 2 years prior to this Saudi attack on Hejaz in the Shia-majority eastern Persian Gulf Coast region, which the Saud had conquered and devastated 15 years prior to that. This makes Saudi Arabia the only country in the region whose oil was always directly under U.S. control from the very beginning and never under British control, a matter which bothered the British for years, as shown in later declassified documents from that era. The absolute monarchy of Saudi Arabia has been passed on after the death of Abdul Aziz in 1953 until today, from one of his sons to another, from half-brother to half-brother. This being possible because he had so many sons that there are debates about how many he actually sired, the most common figure mentioned being around 50. This is, however, all changing now as his son Salman, the current monarch, has appointed his son Muhammad as the crown prince and heir apparent, trying to establish the monarchy in his own line of descendants and excluding the approximately 5,000 other Saudi princes from the royal succession in perpetuity. Muhammad bin Salman has already shown his family values before becoming king, when he arrested dozens of his most influential cousins and imprisoned them in a luxury hotel until they pledged allegiance and transferred billions of dollars of their wealth to him. Muhammad bin Salman's irrational actions on the international scene, such as beginning the genocidal war on Yemen, kidnapping, murder, and literal butchering of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, or kidnapping, beating, and forced televised resignation of former Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, have brought more unwanted attention to the rule of the Al Saud in these few years than in all the 70 years prior to that. Prior to Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudis maintained a media policy of not being spoken about in the media, a policy enforced for decades by bribing and buying, or when necessary, threatening, imprisoning, and killing journalists, dissidents, and media owners around the world. The family rule of the Al Saud is entering uncharted territory as the family business is passing from the brother's generation to the cousin's generation and the attempt to consolidate the monarchy in the Salman line. There has never been a real national feeling in this nation named after a family, with many regions maintaining their distinct identity. Regions such as Hijaz, or the Shia-majority Persian Gulf Coast, or the southern regions of Najran, Asir, and Jizan, which have historically, culturally, and religiously always been part of Yemen, and were part of the regions conquered and annexed by Abdul Aziz in the 20th century. It remains to be seen if the next generation of people on the Arabian Peninsula will forego their natural right to self-determination and elected government and passively accept continued absolute monarchy and the concentration of biblical levels of wealth in the hands of the Al Saud family in return for being allowed to celebrate Halloween or to occasionally attend the concerts of scantily dressed female pop singers. And if history is a guide, it is improbable that this tribal family rule, dressed up as a nation-state, will survive in its current form.
Ali Al-Ahmad, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You're joining us from Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. And I'm very glad that you accepted our invitation, because we want to talk about Saudi Arabia, a subject which, if you look at the way it's treated in the mainstream media in the West, it's always done in a very bad way. It's done in a way where either they don't talk about Saudi Arabia or they do it in a very caricature way. And with your permission, I want to focus our conversation on the domestic internal realities that exist in Saudi Arabia, because I believe that this is an area where we have very little information and very little analysis that's been done. And of course, we always try to talk to persons who are from the country that we're talking about. So, alhamdulillah, we have a chance to talk to you about these issues. So, who are the ones in Washington who are really behind Mohammed bin Salman?
In Washington, people who are extremely loyal to Israel, mm-hmm. Sort of the organizations sort of related, for example, you talk about IPAC and its right. Offsprings, organizations and politicians, and Netanyahu loyalists and Netanyahu supporters. Those kind of those and some new conservative, not all, want this relationship between Mohammed bin Salman or the Saudi state and Israel, and that's all they care about.
Right.
So to them, nothing else matters. Murders, killing, it doesn't matter. He's wonderful as long as he is doing what's good for Israel. And I think the steps that Mohammed bin Salman honestly did helped Israel, like Sisi, for example, when they had the right. transfer of the islands from Egypt to Saudi Arabia. The number one benefactor of this is Israel,
exactly.
because now they have access to the northern Red Sea, so they can just go through international waters without having to go through shallow waters between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And they don't have to pay the Egyptians anything or request permission.
Right. So let's look a little bit more to other players, to other groups in Saudi Arabia. We talked a little bit about Al Saud. If there's anything else you want to add about Al Saud, please go ahead.
What I'm saying that the Al Saud people think that all of them have interest in politics. Most of them are, you know, I've met dozens of them. A lot of them, they are extremely, they understand that they want to keep the regime. Mm-hmm. They might dislike Mohammed bin Salman, but at the time that anything threatens the regime, they will not do it because it means that they will go down too, because they are still princes, receiving special treatment and receiving salaries. So Mohammed bin Salman, yes, he cracked down on many of his cousins, but they continue to receive at least a minimum the status and the money and sort of this luxurious life. So I don't think they want to throw it away, and some of them are willing to just forgo fighting Mohammed bin Salman, and they have paid loyalty. I remember one of them is Bandar bin Sultan, who has a lot of power. He actually went to the palace after Mohammed bin Salman became, and he said, "This is all the money I have. Take it. Whatever you want, I'm under your service." Same thing Mohammed bin Fahd did,
mm-hmm.
and they were rewarded for this. They both came, and they basically said, "We are at your service. Here is the money, and take anything you want." They did not fight it. They did not. And he took the a lot of money, but also he kept something for them. And that's why he rewarded Bandar bin Sultan by appointing his daughter, who mm-hmm. is not very smart,
right.
as an ambassador here, and his son in London, and Mohammed bin Fahd appointing his son as an advisor in the palace. So not everyone is going to fight Mohammed bin Salman. The King Abdullah's children, some of them are in the United Kingdom, but at the same time, they are not coming out publicly. They might try to do things here and there, but mostly it's grumbling. And this is nothing new. The Al Saud, the brother of King Salman, his older brother, Turki, was in Egypt for 30 years,
right?
Because he was upset, and he died there, and nothing happened. So I would not want to pin any hopes mm-hmm. that the monarchy itself will start fighting. This is what destroyed the second, so-called the second Saudi state. But I don't think this is going to be the case here. It might be a factor that there will be infighting, definitely. But I think the demise of this current regime will come in a different manner.
Right.
And it will mostly be from the people. I just wanted to highlight one thing here. Regarding the Saudi ruling clans infighting,
mm-hmm.
Just last year, the personal bodyguard of King Salman, who was also the personal bodyguard of King Abdullah,
yes.
Was killed. You know, he was killed by Mohammed bin Salman because there was a plot to kill Mohammed bin Salman.
Okay, so let's go now, because it seems to me you're saying that if change is going to happen, it's going to come from outside the Al Saud. So
yes.
let's take a look. You mentioned Al-Qahtani, could you give us maybe some insight into who are some of the, as you mentioned, national figures, some of those who are considered maybe higher level than some, as you mentioned, lower level political prisoners that are highlighted. So if you could mention maybe some of those people for us, for the audience who might not be familiar with what's going on in Saudi Arabia.
One of the things that the Saudi regime did successfully, I have to say, that they prevented this country. You know, in Iran, you have national figures. You know, right. You have singers, poets, politicians, right. Activists, you know, media personalities. In our country, we don't have that. What they did, they divided that country into sort of these sections. You're from the south, you're from the north, you're from the center, you're Shia, you're Sunni, and you're from Hijaz, and so on. So the country has really never come around a figure that they can call because, if you're from Najd, this guy's from Hijaz. You're Shia, this guy's Sunni. If you're Sunni, this guy's Shia, and so on. So
right. There's not a real national feeling.
They made sure there is not a national figure. And they did it. They do it, you know, with the advice and help of their Western backers in the UK and in Washington. Just this story that has not made a single Western publication. That even maybe even Press TV. That the current Saudi cabinet right now. Mm-hmm. There was a cabinet shift or a shovel. Couple of maybe a month and a half ago, not all the ministers now in that cabinet are from Najd, from the center right. region of Saudi Arabia, from the same background. So there are no for the first time since the Saudi state, there is not a single minister from the west, from Hijaz.
Right.
There hasn't been a minister from the south, except for 55 days during King Abdullah's time. There hasn't been a single Shia in the cabinet. There hasn't been, a single minister from the north as well. So you and in the east, yes, but not from, not Shia, but very very few over the past 90 years. So we're trying to see here is concentration of power, fearing that something is going to happen. And Mohammed bin Salman is very careful about his safety. He mm-hmm. doesn't go places. He has a lot of bodyguards and security around him. And he uses even foreign mercenaries, Blackwater and others, to play a part in protecting him because he fears, and maybe it's true, that even the CIA tried to get him in 2017 in this mysterious gunfire that took place in 2017 in April, where Riyadh would just... there was a lot of gunfire and nobody knew what happened, and they said, it's just a drone. It was not a drone. It was an assassination attempt, most likely supported by Washington or directed by Washington. I'm not sure the information, but it was not a normal event. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this regime is not stable yet.
Right.
So it will not take huge risks in the region. It will keep everybody on their toes, but it will not move toward the Americans like before, vice versa. It might try to get some protection from the Chinese and the Russians and so on.
Right. So how does the war in Yemen play into all this? Because it seems to me that it's this massive, blunder. A strategic blunder. They were advertising, this is going to be over in 2 weeks, in a month, in 2 months, and it's been years now. And mm-hmm. for the first time, we've had, actually the Yemenis, as I would claim, is their right under international law to actually defend themselves. We actually had, the territory of Saudi Arabia being attacked by Yemen as a defense of the, thousands of airstrikes that have been conducted in Yemen. So how does the war in Yemen play into this instability or this kind of situation that you're describing that's currently happening in Saudi Arabia?
In the war in Yemen, people think that the decision was made in Riyadh. It was not.
Right.
Riyadh was just the one who that carried the knife and stabbed the Yemenis in their right. back. The name, for those who speak Arabic and understand the Arabic language, even the name of the war that the Saudis used, it was not an Arab name. In an Arab in Balagha, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
It was
a translation from English. Asifat al-Hazm, the storm resolved. In Arabic, we don't have such an expression. It does not work, okay, right. in Arabic.
it's no, very clear it was a direct translation from what the Americans...
It was a direct translation, a poor translation.
Right.
The decision was announced.